Hello and welcome to the symposium. A lot of you have asked us to do Marcus Aurelius and meditations, and we're going to do just that. And who better to join me than Bo? As I said just ago, I really like talking to you, and I think that it's a free lesson for me. And I hope you just take as much time as you want with the history stuff.
Okay.
Right, so Marcus Aurelius is, in a sense, a philosopher emperor. He is more than a philosopher king than that Plato hoped for. And he is a surprisingly good philosopher. And I think also he was a good administrator and emperor.
A good man, it seems. Yeah.
So he is basically known for his meditations as far as philosophy is concerned. And we need to say that his meditations was just something like a personal diary. Mm. He never intended for it to be published or for it to be read as a treatise. It's, you could say, a form of practice where he writes to himself and he reminds of himself several stuff. So, for instance, we say about the Stoics that they constantly say that we should remember that we're going to die, the memento mori stuff. He constantly does this. Mm-hmm. It's every fifth quote is about him talking to himself about how nature changes and he is going to change by implication.
I think it is like a diary.
Yes.
The fact that you can buy it now, I think Marcus Aurelius would probably be appalled if he knew that. Probably be embarrassed. Yeah, the fact that it's called Meditations and it's broken into 12 books, all that was after the fact.
Yes.
It was found in his possession after he died. He never wrote it for publication.
Yes. And let's say that he's one of the major Stoics, but he's also very late in Stoicism. So Stoicism had been a thing for about 500 years before he started writing his meditations. It was a way of life, you could say, as much as it was a philosophical way of thinking about the world. And you can say that the way he wrote in his meditations does suggest a Stoic temperament and a form of Stoic practice, where he constantly tries to articulate what he thought was the best way of being. And also he constantly tries to remind himself that he is mortal, but he also has a divine soul. He thought that this applied for all human beings. And he is fleshing out really well and interestingly his conception of what the Stoics mentioned, the path of nature or the life of reason, which was, according to them, the path of virtue. So he has a very distinctive social element into it, which is very interesting. So we need to remember that he is talking to himself, but he is talking to himself in a way that applies to that we could say that it generates no problem for us to think that he was also talking to other people, because he says to himself stuff that are grounded upon a universal human nature as he sees it. So the fact that he writes to himself and he talks to himself doesn't mean that he has no message to give us. Mm. Now, obviously, if he's telling, you know, go and be a good emperor of Rome, that's not an applicable message nowadays. Mm. It's not something that people can practice. But he has, for the most part, a level of generality in his suggestions that applies to all human beings. So I think we should talk about him as a person first and talk a bit about his life and then talk about some of the maxims we can extract from his meditations. There are loads. I just found around 19 or 20 to share with you. And then we're going to go even more philosophical when we talk about his views about philosophy, cosmology, ontology, virtue, fame and other people. And I will end with some sort of critical, but also in a constructively manner, critical way when he's talking about fatalism and death, especially the death of children. So, yeah, let's talk about his life.
A couple of quick things on what you've just said there. So he's the latest, the last of the great Stoics, perhaps. So he was completely aware of Seneca and Epictetus and the entire Stoic tradition. Absolutely, yeah. And you mentioned Plato there. I think that's that's good. It's like Plato could only have dreamt of having one, a king, quote unquote, or in this case, an emperor, as powerful as Marcus Aurelius, sort of the master of most of the known world, and as philosophical as him. And you're absolutely right that most things, nearly everything really in the meditations, are just sort of universal things for living life just as a human, just as a man, not as the ruler of the known world. Yes. That's why it's so, why it's still so interesting and useful.
And he reminds to himself that he shouldn't be proud and that he is sort of bringing himself down a bit. So he must have been very aware that all the power he commanded could make him prone to abuse it.
Yeah.
And he had to discipline himself and he had to exercise the virtues. And speaking of Plato, I think we will definitely talk about it when we talk about his view on virtue. But Marcus Aurelius does inherit the old eudaimonistic framework. And he does seem to think that the four cardinal virtues are the ones that Plato held them to be. Mm. And he sort of defines them in a very similar way. We will definitely flesh this out in due time.
Okay.
So what about his life? I think he had a momentous life, an eventful life.
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. God, yeah. So the story of Marcus Aurelius's reign is inextricably bound up with Hadrian in the first instance. So to put it in some context, there's the so-called five good emperors. Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, and then Marcus Aurelius, sort of bookended by terrible emperors. Obviously, Commodus comes after Marcus Aurelius. Perhaps one of the most obvious examples of how Marcus Aurelius as a man failed is how terrible Commodus is. He failed to raise a son not to be monstrous. But anyway, that's something else. Anyway, the story of Marcus Aurelius, yeah. So Hadrian, we'll have to start with Hadrian, really. Hadrian was adopted by Trajan. Let's go back to Trajan, actually. When Trajan realised he was dying, or at least he needed to secure an heir, he decided just to adopt an already powerful and capable man of the state, and he chose Hadrian. Now, when Hadrian came to the end of his years, or was beginning to, he was childless. And he chose one particular heir. That guy died. He picked somebody else. He picked Antoninus Pius. And also, at the same time, insisted that Antoninus Pius, who had children of his own, adopt Marcus Aurelius, who was only young. He was like a teenager, I believe, at the time. So in other words, Hadrian picked, personally hand-picked, both Antoninus Pius and Marcus Aurelius. So Marcus Aurelius was from a very well-to-do, pretty well-to-do family, not patrician. Hadrian made him a patrician, but still very well-to-do. Like, his father had been a praetor, the second rank in the state below consul. His grandfather had been consul two or three times. On his mother's side, there were consuls. So his family were, statesman-like families, both sides of his family. And yet it seems that he was sort of picked out or groomed from the earliest of ages to be something important, not necessarily an heir to the throne, to the purple, but was sort of very much groomed to be something important in the Roman state from a very, very early age. Just to jump ahead slightly, when he was formally adopted into the line of succession, I think he was about 17, something like that, apparently he was appalled by that. He thought it was terrible. He sort of steeled himself straight away to not be completely corrupted. There's the old adage, isn't there, Lord Acton, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Marcus Aurelius is an exception to that rule. As a young man, as a child and as a teenager, he was deeply into his learning. He was apparently very serious character, not a frivolous person. was very, very interested in learning and his education and philosophy. There's one story I think speaks volumes that, again, when he was a child, he took to wearing the green cloak of a philosopher and sleeping on the floor without any bedding. No one had told him to do that. No one had ordered him to do it. He just decided to do that. So I think, first of all, he was just a very, very serious character and pretty harsh on himself, insisted that he himself live by rules like that. So, in other words, kind of the opposite of somebody like Caligula or Nero or Tiberius, who indulged all their craziest pleasures and whims. The opposite of that. Very, very, very self-denying, very, very strict with himself from the earliest possible age. So you can sort of see why Hadrian might have, his eye might have fallen on him as a good pick, a good pick for the imperial lion. So if I could zoom out a little bit from there, one of the things Gibbon says, I love Edward Gibbon, I mention Gibbon all the time, don't I, quote from Gibbon. Gibbon's book, although he goes back at various stages during the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, although he goes back all the time to talk about things in the Republic or talk about the age of Augustus, it really starts with the age of the Antonines. Quite often Antoninus Pius and Marcus Aurelius are collectively called the Antonines. And Edward Gibbon's book kind of starts with the age of the Antonines. And Gibbon says it's a golden age. It's the great, it's the greatest period in Imperial Roman history. He goes a bit far, really, in my opinion, in most people's opinion. He says, if you could live at any time in history, you want to live under Antoninus Pius.
That's or Marcus Aurelius. That's the gold period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's this concept of the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. Well, certainly under Trajan, there wasn't a great deal of peace. Trajan was a great military emperor, sort of lots and lots of wars under Trajan. Under Hadrian, there was, even though he'd stabilised the borders and stopped trying to expand, there's still all sorts of wars. But under Antoninus Pius, there was quite a long, profound peace. Antoninus Pius ruled for a long time, like well over 20 years, closer to 30 years, a long, long time. I think one of the longest reigns of any emperor. And there was a long peace there. But under Marcus Aurelius, there's lots of wars. And Gibbon says things like, it is a bit over the top, really. He says things like, the best men ever to rule large empires were the two Antonines. The greatest period of Rome was under them. Well, there was a massive plague, for example, under Marcus Aurelius. Probably not, not the bubonic plague or pneumonic plague, but probably something like smallpox or maybe measles. Something that killed like 10% of the entire empire's population. Some sort of terrible pandemic. So that's not great. There were lots of wars, both in the east against the Parthians and in the north on the Danube and the Rhine against various German tribes. So, okay, maybe living under the reign of Antoninus Pius might have been some sort of golden age, but not, I don't think, really under Marcus Aurelius. But, sorry, go ahead. You look like you're going to say something.
No.
Yeah, so there's lots to say. When he was first adopted, something you have to say very quickly about ancient Roman adoption is it's not the same as modern adoption. You could adopt a full-grown man. It's just sort of a legal way to make sure that estates and money and power, titles, hereditary powers are passed down to the person you want. It's not like they actually become, you only really adopt children and they become your child the way we do it. It wasn't like that. There was a long tradition that you could adopt, an old man who's dying can adopt a 40-year-old guy. We don't think of adoption like that. But anyway, that's how they did it. Anyway, when Hadrian adopted Antoninus Pius and forced him to adopt Marcus Aurelius, it's sort of a massive leap. Marcus Aurelius, although being born and raised into sort of the very upper echelons of Roman society, would never have dreamt that he would end up being a prince, essentially a prince, an heir. well, a Caesar. He becomes, when he's adopted, he becomes a Caesar. He's allowed to call himself a Caesar. Nick could never really have dreamt of that. And I think that's interesting because 17 is old enough, or in your late teens, it's old enough to have had all your formative years, really, without that, right? Without the psychology of that. Quite often, royal children or children of billionaires or something, you're raised from the earliest possible age being told you're very, very, very special. You're the one, you're the chosen one, you're the golden child. That screws with people's psychology. Quite often it makes for a weird adult in all sorts of ways. Weird is probably character. Not the right word. but the fact Marcus Aurelius didn't have that, and he'd already reached manhood, well, literally, technically manhood in the Roman world, by the time that happened to him, he'd already formed, it seems, well, did, had already formed his sort of, his worldview. Most of his character had already been formed. And as I say, that character was very serious, very studious, philosophically minded, and sort of kind. I mean, maybe not as kind as the kindest people in our world, but for the Roman world, very kind.
Yeah.
He was interested in not extending the amount of human misery there is in the world.
Yes.
But again, there's many emperors, you can say that's not the case.
I think it would be a good idea if we located him in time.
Okay.
Because he was born, I think, in 121 AD.
Yep.
In Rome, I think.
Yeah, just outside Rome, I think, yes. Yeah.
And he died in around 180 AD.
Yeah, yeah.
So he lived for close to 59 years.
Yeah.
He was, I think Hadrian died around 138 AD.
That's right, I believe, yeah.
Yeah. And Marcus became emperor in 161. Somewhere there, I think.
Yeah. I think
and I think his name was Marcus Annaeus Verus. Mm-hmm. And then he switched it to Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah.
And as you say, yes, the reign of Antoninus Pius most probably was a bit better. And they say that when Marcus became emperor, he had all sorts of problems that were just ready to happen. That sort of gives us a kind of perspective where we could say that the reign of Antoninus Pius was a sort of calm before the storm. And because it was so calm, lots of things erupted.
Mm.
And as you said, there were the Parthians that I think attacked the kingdom of Armenia.
That's right, yeah.
And then, as you said, all sorts of tribes in the north. And I think Meditations was written during the Marco-Manic Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that it was very bleak. He lived in very bleak times and he experienced very bleak conditions, and that Meditations was also a form of inner cope. And I don't mean this in a bad sense. I mean this in a, maybe that's a wrong word. I mean it in the sense that he was trying to come to terms with...
In the old school sense of the word cope, not in the modern internet usage.
Yes,
helping you to cope with things.
Yes, actually helping you to deal with things.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think I've read that he was a very good judge of character, and... I mean, that's debatable, because I think there was another story with Avidius Cassius.
Right, yeah.
Cassius. And that may not have been the best choice of person eventually, but that's debatable. But what I heard being said about him is that he was a good judge of character, especially during the Marco-Manic Wars. And he had no problem or, you know, massive ego that would interfere with him delegating duties and responsibilities to capable people, and that he was prudent in that respect. So he doesn't seem to have been a person who wouldn't handle bad news or who would penalize his officers for bringing him bad news or something.
So a few things to say. Even though he was very well read, a type of philosopher king, he wasn't martial. He had no experience. He'd never been a military tribune or anything. He'd never been in camps and stuff. So he was not warlike. He didn't know, genuinely didn't know about battlefield tactics and grand strategy or anything like that. That was a really important thing missing from his CV, if you like. So when he became emperor, You know, some military, some leaders sort of just insist that they're also a great commander without any proper experience. Hitler's an example of this. He'd only ever been a corporal. But when he was leader of Germany during World War II, he sort of put himself above field marshals, telling them what to do. And anyway, Hitler wasn't a great strategist, essentially. Anyway, neither was Stalin. But Stalin recognised that he wasn't, at least after a while, and just started delegating all military matters to his generals.
After having killed around 200 of the most capable ones.
Right, yeah. So Marcus Aurelius did the same thing. He wasn't so proud that he couldn't delegate military matters to the right people. And again, it speaks of his ego, not having a massive ego, right? And one other person we do have to mention is Lucius Varus. Yeah. So at the same time that Antoninus Pius was adopted by Hadrian and Antoninus Pius had to adopt Marcus Aurelius, he also had to adopt Lucius Varus, who it was sort of like a backup in a way.
Plan B.
Yeah, should Marcus Aurelius die or something, or be killed in some way, there would be a backup heir. So, when Hadrian dies, both Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Varus are made sort of heirs legally. And in fact, when Antoninus Pius dies, Marcus Aurelius is voted, in inverted commas, up to the purple by the Senate. He insists that Lucius Varus become joint emperor with him. He will be the senior emperor, but nonetheless, sort of a joint emperorship. Now, that sort of thing, usually, nearly always, is just a recipe for disaster. It means that those two men will become rivals, or even if they're not personally rivals, their factions will become rivals. But it didn't happen. Again, speaks volumes for the character of Marcus Aurelius, that he was able to not end up in some sort of civil war with Lucius Varus. But a quick word on Lucius Varus is that apparently he was martial, he was strong, physically strong, and into gladiatorial games and fighting and being bombastic, being a bit of a womanizer, a bit of a drunk, not crazily so, but like to indulge his pleasures and all that sort of thing. Kind of the opposite of Marcus Aurelius. Apparently Marcus Aurelius wasn't all that strong. He was a bit sickly. Mm. He wasn't a great, strong warrior person, Marcus Aurelius, but this Lucius Varus was. So the fact that they contrasted so heavily is interesting. Anyway, just to cut him short, because I could do a whole epochs about the life of Lucius Varus, but just to cut that short, he was sent out to, once they became emperors, he was sent out to Parthia to fight. Was it Vologeses? Was the
Vologeses?
Yeah,
the fourth.
Vologeses the fourth, the ruler of Parthia. They invaded Armenia successfully, then pushed down into Syria, and Rome sent armies to push them back, which they did. Lucius Varus was in command there. On his way back from there, or towards the end of the Parthian adventure, Lucius Varus dies, whether of natural causes, whether it was poisoning. Cassius Dio says it was food poisoning, not necessarily an assassination poisoning, but just... Anyway, point is, he died, leaving Marcus Aurelius to be the sole emperor for like the second half or more of his reign, his long reign, like 20 years. Must mention Lucius Varus. We can't talk about the history or the life of Marcus Aurelius without mentioning Lucius Varus. But okay, moving on from that. He had Marcus Aurelius talking about cope in the old school sense of the word cope. Stoicism helps you cope. And he lived a life filled with death and mourning. His wife, Faustina, they had something like 13 or 14 children, most of which died in infancy. So that old Stoic thing is be sure to kiss your children goodnight because they might be dead in the morning. Be prepared for your children to be dead on any given morning that you wake up. Marcus Aurelius actually lived that.
Yeah.
Had loads of children that died on him. Yeah. His wife died on him eventually. Lucius Varus died on him that he needed him. And seemed to have loved him as a brother, sort of thing. Lots and lots of people died on Marcus Aurelius.
And the one that didn't die ended up being Commodus.
Right, yeah. Commodus was actually a twin. He had a twin brother, I think it was, who died. And yeah, I suppose maybe we'll talk about that towards the end. Maybe makes more sense to talk about his failure as a father when it comes to Commodus. But he tried. Gibbon and Cassius Dio tell us about how hard Marcus Aurelius tried to bring Commodus upright. And it seemed, it just failed. Sometimes, you see it sometimes, don't you? That despite all efforts in childhood and in adolescence, someone becomes an adult and they're bad. They're a bad person despite everything. Yeah, it seemed like there's nothing you could do. Yeah. It was hard baked into them to be a bad person. But anyway, so well, one other quick thing before we go on is that the war with Parthia in the East, and they brought back, it seems the armies, the legionaries, brought back this plague with them from the East. And it spread all throughout the empire, but hit the army itself quite hard, very hard, to the point where Marcus Aurelius was struggling to have enough men to control the border regions on the Danube. But he had to deal with that. There were sort of three separate campaigns. He had to keep going back there.
Yeah.
He'd think he'd won. He'd sort of go across the Danube, defeat them, in inverted commas, sort of replace their leader with some sort of puppet. And then, like, a year or two later, they'd overthrow him.
Yeah,
And he'd have to come back. Again. So there were three separate wars, really. And so, again, you have to... That's dealing with quite a big defeat, sort of a personal defeat.
Yeah.
A political, big political personal defeat. Now, how do you deal with that? How do you pick yourself up from that?
I think it speaks a lot about his character, how he conducted himself during these times of trouble and turmoil, because it was turmoil.
Yeah.
You just mentioned that in the 19 years he ruled, it wasn't just the peaceful time. There were more than three wars, a plague, endless fighting with tribes. So...
A massive rebellion, you mentioned Cassius.
Yeah.
Just to say about that super quick, one of the most important guys that helped win the Parthian War was left as governor out in the East.
In Egypt, I think. Was it Avidius Cassius?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at one point, lots of the provinces in the East declared for Cassius. That's a massive defeat, isn't it? Like a personal... sort of political defeat. But in the end, one of Cassius's own centurions beheaded him and it was all over. But that's the barest of bare bones of that story.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, sort of a near endless string of struggles.
Yeah.
Some people think, I used to think, when I didn't know as much, that is a bit rich for someone like Marcus Aurelius, i.e. the most powerful man in the world with endless wealth, all the pleasures that he could ever want at his fingertips. It's a bit rich for him to talk about, like, be humble and don't worry about wealth and don't worry about the pursuit of power and things. That's easy for you to say, Marcus Aurelius, already finding yourself at the pinnacle of the world. But that's not fair, that's not right, that's a completely wrong way of looking at it. Mm. That's not really what he was about, that's not what his meditations are about at all. In fact, almost the exact opposite is true, in a way, that it's unbelievably remarkable that when we get into the meditations, that what it is, you know, I think most people in the world, including myself, if you had basically limitless power and money, you would end up abusing it to different degrees. I like to think I wouldn't be all that bad, but at some point you would abuse it. At some point you'd spend loads of money on a completely frivolous thing.
Yeah.
At some point I might buy sort of a chrome-plated Rolls Royce for the sake of it, right? If you had endless money, you effectively had all the money in the world. You might go mad with women, right? If there's endless women throwing themselves at you, you might indulge. Right. You know, And he never did, or whatever it was, not just women and money, but all, anything and everything. You might, if you could have all the food you love, just endless amounts, you could become a glutton very easily. You might love caviar or whatever it is. You know, you just endlessly eat caviar and drink champagne, and then it's a cliche.
Endless burgers or something.
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah. You might just love pulled pork and Guinness. And so that's all you eat and drink because you can.
Yeah.
Right. To not indulge in any of that, sort of ever, is absolutely remarkable, absolutely incredible, really.
I know
I'm not strong enough.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.